Like to call to order the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance comes to order today, February 3, 2011. Committee Legislative Assistant, would you take the roll?
Representative Smith?
Here.
Szymanski?
Here.
Johnson?
Here.
Anderson?
Here.
Chapman is excused. Cornish? Grunhagen?
Here.
Gilstrom?
Here.
Frezel?
Here.
Lane is excused. Lesh, Liebling, Mazarol.
Here.
Schumacher.
Here.
Kilbride. Vogel.
Here.
Wardlow.
Here.
Ready to quorum.
Chair notes the presence of a quorum. First thing we'll do on the agenda is consider the minutes. Then we have House File 57 that we'll take up. Then we will have an overview presented by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. With regard to the minutes from February 1, 2011, they're in the packet. May I have a motion to approve those?
So moved.
Representative Grunhagen moves approval of the minutes for February 1, 2011. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Minutes of February 1, 2011 are approved. Members, also we need to make a conforming change to the previous minutes. They're also in your packet, and I think those are dated January 18, January 25. If you take a minute to look at those, after some discussion with some members of this committee and looking at those, I'm asking for a motion to amend those minutes.
So moved.
Representative Johnson moves to amend the previous minutes from those two dates. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Members, one point we have in your packet somewhere, the copy of the legislative auditor's report from January 20, 2001 on the district courts. As you might recall, there was a reference question or a reference made to this report during our court overview and a request for the copy. So it's in your packet for your convenience. All right, Representative Kreisel, strap in, get ready. Chair wants to bring your bill now before the committee. Is there a motion to approve House File 57?
I'd like to move my bill.
Representative Kreisel moves House File 57. Before we proceed, I think on the agenda we have three scheduled witnesses. Is there anyone not on the scheduled agenda who is here to testify on this bill? Anyone at all, please raise your hand. Okay, Representative Kreisel, go ahead.
All right, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 57 to pass and be placed on the general register.
Go ahead and present.
All right, Mr. Chair and members, a growing hazard is sweeping across the nation and our state. Synthetic marijuana, also known as K2 or spice, is a mixture of common herbs sprayed with synthetic chemicals that mimic the effects of marijuana. It is currently being sold in head shops and stores as incense or a potpourri, but is being used as an inhalant for people to get high. Besides the health risks to individuals using this product, there is an increasing risk to the general public as well. Because synthetic marijuana is not a controlled substance, it is difficult or impossible for users to be prosecuted for driving under the influence. This product is becoming increasingly popular with teenagers because there is no minimum age requirement to purchase the product, and there are hundreds of videos on YouTube demonstrating to teenagers how to use this product to get high. Because of the overall danger, 11 states have outlawed the possession and distribution of this product. House File 57 will make it a gross misdemeanor to unlawfully sell any synthetic cannabinoid and a misdemeanor for possession of the same. This bill will undoubtedly make our communities safer. Mr. Chair, I would like to turn the podium over to my guests to provide their testimony.
Okay, I think the order we have them, Chair would now call Paul Schnell, Police Chief Hastings, and all three, as a matter of fact, Tim Convoy, Rosemount High School Administrator, and James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. Welcome, gentlemen. Come on forward.
Good
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, my name is Paul Schnell. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Hastings. I appreciate the opportunity to present to you today about the issues related to synthetic marijuana. This past summer, in the City of Hastings, a 14-year-old boy who had had contact with one of his cousins from a neighboring community and who had obtained a package of synthetic marijuana from a local tobacco shop decided that he wanted to try the substance. He smoked it and had a serious, significant medical reaction to the chemicals that were contained in the product. As a result, he was taken to the local emergency room and required some rather significant medical intervention. This caused his mother to be understandably concerned about the fact that the substance was so readily available. She herself went to a local tobacco shop in a neighboring community and found it easy to access and wanted to see what it was about. On the basis of her concern, she approached the City of Hastings staff, she approached City of Hastings elected officials, and requested and asked that the city consider local ordinance regulating the use, possession, and distribution of synthetic marijuana. City elected leadership asked city staff to review and research the issue, and in, upon doing so, we obviously shared her great concern for the dangerousness of the substance and its potential impact on public safety in our community, and yet we realized that creating a local ordinance would lack the ability of having a more comprehensive sweeping policy that would be the same in one community to the next. In our own community, if we went to the middle of Hastings, you could go 2 miles in any direction and be able to legally obtain, possess, or sell the substance. And for some reason, we would suggest that creating an ordinance would somehow make Hastings safer. We did not believe that would be the case. As a result, we approached the city leadership and requested at that point in time that, that they support a resolution recommending and authorizing staff to support any legislative initiatives to create a broad, comprehensive statewide policy to address this substance. I am here today not only representing my community, but I represent many of my colleagues in the law enforcement community. Officers in my community and all across Minnesota are seeing and coming into contact with the substance in traffic stops, coming into contact with the substance at in local college campuses where it's being widely used, and have no ability to take any action whatsoever. We appreciate the position you are in relative to consideration around regulating the substance. We do believe that the passage of this law, as proposed by Representative Pressel, will in fact create a safer community in the City of Hastings, and certainly we believe that it will benefit the public safety of all of Minnesota. I'm here today to offer my strong support of the legislation as presented, and would stand for any questions at a later time.
Chief Snell, I appreciate your testimony and you being here. Any questions from anyone on the committee? The Chief. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chief. It seems like every few years another one of these comes along. I don't know how long it was ago, 15 years ago or something, that ecstasy popped up, and maybe we could address that by cutting off funding to chemistry departments and schools or something. My question is, what do you anticipate is going to be the next thing that we see based on the type of chemical that, that's out there or the manner in which it's ingested?
Chief Snell. Chief Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I think we were talking even before we came down today about the fact that already we're beginning to see a variety of different substances being used for ingestion, and there is common chemicals and common spices that that young people have either historically been able to use or are emerging because of advances in chemistry. This is one of those things where I'm fearful that as public safety officials and as legislators, we're always going to be one step behind. I think that the benefit of a bill like this is that there was a comprehensive effort to try and address as much of the chemistry issues to, so that we didn't run into a problem of slight changes in the chemistry would make the substance that people are now trying to use legal. What exactly that will be, I do not know, but I am confident that we will patch one hole and find an emerging another hole for substances of abuse.
Representative Lett.
Thank you for that, Chief. And you know, the way that last I looked at the controlled substance laws, it has, you know, the drug and it's isomers and it's salts of isomers, so you can't modify one molecule and come down to it. Do you think that has been a particularly effective way to do this, to legislate this policy, these kinds of policies?
Chief Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lust, yes, I do think that we have had some success. Bath salts are now one of the considerations, the substances that we were discussing. But I do believe that making very clear that slight modifications of the molecular structure does in fact create an effective policy so that we do not run into a problem of slight changes causing difficulties for law enforcement or for prosecution.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know too much about this particular area, the synthetic marijuana thing, but you know, I do have a concern though about you know, in general, I think that we should not criminalize things that consenting adults like, unless there's a real reason. You know, and I'm not really clear here. I heard you say that teenagers are using it. And they're using it to get high, I assume. But I didn't hear anything about any of the harm from the getting high. I heard you say that one teenager had a medical issue. You didn't specify what that was. I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more about what the harm is here. I mean, because there are lots of things, you know, you could go and get a can of whipped cream and take the aerosol and inhale it and get high, you know. There are lots and lots of things people can do to get high and many things that can hurt them. You know, you can inhale paint thinner. You know, lots of hazardous substances out there that teenagers can and do use all the time. I mean, we know that adolescence itself seems to be kind of a, you know, you can think of it as a mental illness that everybody goes through and grows out of, in a way. Some people grow out of it, right, Representative Lesh. So I think before we criminalize things and add to the burden of our court system and our law enforcement, which as we all know here on this committee, we're very overburdened and having a great deal of difficulty processing the cases that we already have. And, you know, I'm concerned about adding to that backup for something that, you know, where the harm doesn't rise to the level that it needs that approach. Can you address that for me, please?
Representative Crest.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the stats that I have on it are in 2009 there were around 12 calls to poison control centers nationwide regarding synthetic marijuana, but then in 2010 there were 2,867, and then so far in 2011 there's already 217 calls. There have been zero deaths to overuse or overdose, but there's been one suicide linked to it. Symptoms are a blood pressure of 200 over 120. So there is a side effect problem with it. It is much more dangerous than regular marijuana, which you won't, I mean, that's crazy to say that it's safer to use regular marijuana than it is to use this, but that's the case. Last in the Public Safety Committee, we had Dr. Cody Weidberg, who's the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. He testified as far as the chemical makeup. There's around 150 different chemicals that can be in this. It's made in very dirty, non-regulated factories. And so that's a lot of the problem in it, is almost anything can wind up in this stuff, and it is making people sick.
Any further questions? Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Is Representative Kriesel, is it sold? How is this sold? I mean, is it sold to be smoked, or, and And second question I have as well is, I don't think your bill is limited to children, is it? This is you're banning this for everybody.
Representative Kreisel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, it is currently marketed as incense or potpourri, and it says not for human consumption, but it's names like, you know, Mr. Happy, it has marijuana leaves on there. It's kind of the wink, wink, nod, nod that, okay, you're not supposed to smoke it, but it's that's what it's being used for, and the people that own these head shops know that, and it's placed near the pipes that are often used for marijuana, tobacco pipes or whatnot. It's near that stuff, and so it is kind of one of those, they skirt the laws.
All right, we have two other witnesses.
Oh, and then Mr. Chair, it would make it illegal for anyone, not just minors, to use it, because right now there's no minimum age to purchase this stuff.
Two other witnesses at the table. Which one would like to proceed next?
Yep.
Give us your name, sir, and go ahead.
My name is Dr. Timothy Conroy. I'm the assistant principal at Rosemont High School. A member of one of Minnesota's larger school districts. And I'm representing myself, but this is also the information that I share with you will be based on my involvement on the Safe and Drug-Free Schools Committee, of which I'm a part of, and also, anecdotally speaking, other members of the administrative teams from not only the schools in our district, including middle schools, and the other senior high schools, but schools around Minnesota. I think I very much appreciate your last question, and when Representative Kreisel used the word it mimics marijuana, I think that's the intended purpose, but our experience has been very concerning. We've had 5 incidents in the last 2 years with synthetic marijuana, 2 of which were extremely significant disruptive events. And I'd like to just kind of go through one of those situations with you so you can get a feel for what we deal with in the schools. I'll just kind of go start to finish on what happened. We had a young man who was brought in by one of our teachers for kind of loitering in the halls, and he kind of looked like he was, you know, having a difficult time. So he was brought to our office, placed in an office. I went out to ask my secretary a question, turned around, and he was on the floor of my office, vomiting, convulsing. He had tipped over a chair. Our nurse was just around the corner from my office. We, of course, summoned her immediately, called 911. She came into the office, was extremely alarmed, and this is a seasoned nurse, was extremely alarmed because of the heart rate, and also we have an EMT who teaches an EMT class in our building. He was summoned out of his class, leaving a number of students without a teacher, but came down, was extremely concerned as well because of the blood pressure and also the heart rate. The student was not responding, and we weren't sure, we had no idea what was going on. We, of course, checked his pockets. My secretary got a hold of his parent, who happened to be a person that did not understand English very well. And so he came, came up to the high school as quickly as possible, about the same time that the ambulance crew and our first responders, we had a couple of other police officers, our EMTs representing the fire department, and then, of course, the ambulance crew. So we had all these entities at our school, and people are very concerned about this young man. Of course, there's in a high school, you can imagine with cell phones and text messaging that all of a sudden every kid in school knew that there was a major issue going on in the office. So you can just assume that learning had stopped for the entire school, because it did. And at the same time, we think that we're going to lose a student. We have no idea what's going on. The student was initially unable to speak. And this is what I've noticed in the other incidents as well. After they go through this significant area where they're very concerning and the vomiting and that type of thing, they become very belligerent. And this student did not, but a different student who's an extremely nice young man normally, when he had his issue with this synthetic marijuana, actually physically assaulted one of our staff and normally would never, ever think of doing anything like that. And this is a staff member with whom he had a great relationship with. But the student was finally admitted that he smoked something, and what in the world could this be? As time went on, the student's condition improved. Of course, he was taken to the hospital. It was, of course, a very difficult experience for the family because of the, the cost of the ambulance service and the initial ER visit and all of this. Very difficult for them to come up with the funds to pay for that set aside. But and then we started asking ourselves, what in the world was this? Our school resource officer did some research and said, this is what it is. And it's, of course, at the time we called it K2, not synthetic marijuana. Now, of course, we're using the term synthetic marijuana. But that's just one example. We had a second case that was almost as significant. And then we've had three, like I told you, we've had a total of five. One was not quite as involved, and then one of them occurred in our parking lot. And by the time we became involved, the student was in a car and had gone through this intense problem with the high heart rate, the high blood pressure, and the vomiting and that type of thing in his car. And so speaking on the behalf of the administrators in our district and the administrators that I've talked to, we feel this is a much greater problem than marijuana. All of us were kind of joking that we've never had to call 911 when somebody's been found to be high on marijuana. And so we feel that this is an extremely disruptive product, and it has the biggest problem, though, is this. Right now, students are bragging to each other that they can have this product and that we can't do anything about it. And when I'm talking about we, it means, well, for us, it's school administration and staff, but also law enforcement. And so I'm very concerned that there's going to be a cultural change and we're going to be seeing much more of this than we, down the road if we don't take an action like this. So we would very much appreciate that if this bill could move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Conboy. Any questions from the committee? If not, thanks again. And now we'll turn to Dakota County Attorney James Backstrom. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney, appearing here also on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which supports the outline of this dangerous substance. Synthetic cannabinoids are, as Representative Lesh referred to earlier, the most recent advent of the so-called designer drugs in our society. Designer drugs are pharmaceuticals that are created or reformulated if the drug already exists to avoid current law by modifying the molecular structure of those drugs to varying degrees. These things have been around for significant periods of time. In the 1920s, we had synthetic hallucinogens, LSD, PCP started to develop. In the 1960s, as Representative Lesh mentioned, the ecstasy came onto the scene. We've had anabolic steroids that we've all watched the problems associated with those in recent years. These things are dangerous substances, and they adversely impact a lot of people, as you've heard directly from a couple of the witnesses today about young people that have been using this substance. It's dangerous. It basically increases heart rate, increases blood pressure. It causes hallucinations. It can cause convulsions. And, you know, no one knows what is in these substances when you're taking it. You have no idea how strong it is or anything else. There's no control whatsoever. As one commentator put it, it's like playing Russian roulette with chemicals. And we can't allow that as a society to happen. And that's why we're all here today, to ask you to take the steps you need to take as a legislature to set the public policy very clear that this is illegal. It's a controlled substance. Any form of this, and that's why the definitions in the bill are as broad as they are with these chemical formulas, because you have to be broad to avoid people trying to skirt the law. And as the witness at the last hearing testified, he thinks it's a pretty broad definition of as broad as it can be at this time. So that's why we're all here to ask you to support the outline of this particular substance. You've heard a couple of references today that this is even more powerful or more dangerous than marijuana, organic marijuana. And let's not forget for 1 minute that organic marijuana is a serious substance that causes a lot of damage to our society. And I respectfully disagree with Representative Liebling that we should let consenting adults decide what they want to take and not take. As a society, we should never get into the point of legalizing substances like marijuana or other dangerous controlled chemicals that cause lots of damage to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Americans each and every year, and endanger our public safety every day. So our law enforcement community, our prosecutors, our state are strongly behind the need to change this law and outlaw this substance. Thank you.
County Attorney Backstrom, always good to see you. Thank you for your testimony. We'll go to questions now. We've got Representatives Johnson and Liebling. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More comment than a question. I appreciate the bill moving forward. Looks like there's a need for it. The comment I'd have on it, however, is as Representative Lesch alluded to, I got a feeling a year or 2 years down the road there's going to be another type of drug that will be before us. For me, what it points out is the importance of taking a comprehensive perspective on these kinds of issues, and that we need drug prevention training, education. We need good schools, whole communities, families that need help. We need school counselors like Representative Tilbury here. Just looking at one aspect of a drug problem is not sufficient, and we need to take a much more holistic perspective. That being said, I certainly support the bill, but we do need to, as legislators and as public policymakers, really take a more comprehensive perspective.
All right, Representative Liebling, you have the floor. Do we have a question or a counterpoint?
Go ahead. Actually, Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, first of all, Mr. Backstrom, you know, I'm not saying that we should legalize all drugs. I'm saying that when we go to make something, when we go to criminalize something new, we ought to make sure that it really needs to be criminalized, because after all, we are taking freedoms away from adult members of our society, most of whom are very responsible and can make their own personal decisions. So I want to make that really clear. And I hope that everybody here, and I suspect everybody here agrees with that, there ought to be a real reason to criminalize something and take it away from adults. Okay, if this was just children, I think I would be perhaps less concerned, although I still want to make sure that when we put resources toward something, which is what we do when we criminalize it, that we make sure that it's really needed. So that's the first thing. And this is really the first I'm learning about this, and I can accept totally the idea that this is a physically harmful substance if you smoke it, just like so many things would be. And that obviously some people, children, teenagers, a few of them are finding this attractive and want to get into it. Okay. What I haven't really heard is any evidence that criminalizing it actually will reduce the use as a first strategy. And I really appreciate what Representative Johnson said, because we know that there are a lot of things we have to do to impact behavior. And obviously we have a lot of things that are criminalized in society, and sometimes there's even a reverse effect. sometimes adolescents want to try something because it is criminal. And so I have some concern about that. I don't see in the fiscal note, or I see in the fiscal note, that there's no fiscal impact to the health department. And what I'm thinking here is that's probably where there ought to be fiscal impact, because this sounds to me like something where a lot of education is needed. In particular, it sounds like from the terrible incident at the school that, in fact, probably some learning did take place that day, because probably every adolescent who heard about it now realizes that this is dangerous stuff. And maybe that does make it different than marijuana, where they don't hear that. They just hear about how somebody got high and had a good time. So, you know, there may be a sort of a, you know, a self-fulfilling piece there that, unfortunately, somebody had to suffer, but other kids now know that this is playing with fire. So, you know, I still have that concern. I still like to know, what evidence do you have, real evidence, that criminalizing this will, in fact, reduce the use of it? Is there any evidence of that?
Go ahead. Chief Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I appreciate your comments. I also appreciate the comments around prevention. And I want to be the first to say that we recognize that we will never arrest our way out of the problems of substance abuse. We understand that, and we share, I think, in criminal justice, a desire to try and do a good job of education and prevention. I think when we look at the medical impact, the health impact of this is one factor. But when we consider this from a public safety standpoint, our officers are routinely responding to calls for service where the use of synthetic marijuana is influencing things like domestic violence in homes, creating significant levels of problems for parents and children. Our officers are responding to that. Just last week, officers in the city of Hastings made a traffic stop at about 11:30 p.m. In the course of that traffic stop, they encountered some young adults, 19 years old. The driver was 19 years old. He had been, admittedly, and was in possession of the substance that you are all considering outlawing. And there was nothing we could do relative to his possession of that substance and discerning what impact the use of that substance may have had on driving was something that created a significant challenge for our officers. So I do believe that the fact that these are mood-altering substances, we are seeing them in law enforcement influencing our response to calls for service. We share the concern and recognize the need for sound and solid prevention efforts, but I do believe that the use of these substances do in fact create a significant public safety impact in our community on a variety of fronts, and we feel strongly that addressing this both as proposed, outlawing and making it a gross misdemeanor to sell, I think will constrict the ability of access to the substance. And possession as a misdemeanor is, we think, a proportionate response, consistent again with our previously established Minnesota law around the possession of marijuana. And so it is not inconsistent or overly onerous under the circumstances as proposed.
Mr. Chair, could I comment just briefly?
County Attorney Backstrom.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, first of all, I want to apologize if I misunderstood your earlier comments, so I appreciate your perspective, and thank you for clarifying that for me. I just want you, and I want all the committee members to know that this substance right now is being sold illegally in shops all across this state and across this country. It is being packaged as if it were, you know, in small little individual packages. And while they claim it's not for human consumption, as Representative Kreisel indicates, with a wink and a nod, that's exactly what it's being sold for. That's exactly the way it is being marketed through the internet and the sources on YouTube and other videos that show people how to use this to get high. So right now, it is being legally sold. And used by, you know, kids and adults alike across this country. We need to outlaw this, and we need to prevent those sales from occurring. That's what we're going to accomplish when we criminalize the sale of this substance, and that's an important public policy to accomplish, is to restrict the access to it. Will people access illegal drugs? Will they be able to access this illegally? Yes, they will, but it's going to shrink dramatically their ability to do so, and that's what's very important from a public policy perspective.
Dr. Conboy, on this point.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate your question. I think it's a great question. Will making this illegal have an impact? And it is a great question, and I'll be very honest with you. Regardless, and we have a number of people in the schools that work with private agencies and county entities to provide what we hope is very excellent drug education. That said, there will be people that will smoke marijuana and do drugs in schools. There will be people that will never do that. The problem with synthetic marijuana is this. There are people that, there are students that will not do it because it's against the rules. But if we don't make it against the rules, there are people that will try it. And so I think in our position, it's much more dangerous than marijuana and probably some other drugs that I could list. And yet, right now, they can technically possess it and use it. And so that said, I'm concerned about that population and that group that hasn't quite decided if they're going to be someone that smokes or doesn't smoke or uses drugs or doesn't use drugs, because their classmates some of their classmates are encouraging them that, hey, there's nothing wrong with this in terms of it being illegal. And so that's the group that I think will be positively impacted by passing this law.
Okay, next I have Representatives Vogel, then Hillstrom, then Tilbury. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. Has this substance been banned or criminalized in any other state so far?
Representative Kreisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It has been apparently, I thought it was 11. It's now 15 states across the country that it is illegal in.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me start by saying I do support the bill, but I have some technical questions actually about the bill. And I'm not sure who is the correct person to answer this. Mr. Chair, clearly in this bill it now says that on line 1.1 that a person who unlawfully possesses any amount of this is guilty of a misdemeanor. Now, the courts have made many misdemeanors payables, including possession of marijuana in a motor vehicle. So my question is, will this be going on the payables list along with marijuana?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, you know, that would be an issue that, you know, the courts ultimately control what's on the payable list, and it may well become a payable. I guess I can't answer the question, but it is something that certainly the courts have expanded in recent years, the number of crimes that are moved to a payable list, not all of which should be on that from my perspective, but that's basically who controls that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment on that, I agree with you. Many things have been going on the payable list that some of us don't think should be on the payable list. But if this isn't on the payable list, it is now a more severe crime to possess this than it would be to possess marijuana. So I just want the committee to understand that. The second question that I have related to this is also on line 1.1. It just says if you unlawfully possess it. What about if you unlawfully possess it with the intent to sell it?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
With that, we were when we drew up the language of the bill, Representative, we were focusing on the head shop selling it. Because as of now, it doesn't, people don't sell it like they sell marijuana or other drugs that are illegal. So this is something that, you know, we could look at in the future to possibly amend. But we're focused right now on stopping the sale of it in head shops because that's where the problem is coming from.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concern is that right now it is legal, right? And
right.
People can go out and buy everything that's on the shelf before this law goes into effect. And then if you have someone who's possessing it, but they personally intend to sell it, I think we leave that group out.
Out of order, Representative Lesh, you have something on this point.
Thank you. I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And this is just what we in the legislature would call a teachable moment, especially for the new members of the committee, that normally what happens here, the legislature creates laws and the governor signs them. However, in the last few years, after we have stated a certain designation for a crime, it being a misdemeanor, a gross misdemeanor, what have you, the courts have taken it upon themselves to put some of these items on the payables list in order to reduce the number of crimes they have to deal with in the courts, thereby making what was otherwise a criminal offense designated by this committee and signed by the governor into a non-criminal offense. So keep your eyes on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh, also pointing out another example of American ingenuity. Representative Tilbury, then Grunhagen. Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I guess I've been in those situations in schools where I've seen that, and it is very frightening to see a child in that situation without knowing exactly what's going on. And so I've seen it many times, and far too many times. And even when you described it, it didn't get to the intensity that was there. And that's one of the things I wanted to just point out to the committee, that is, like I said, one of the most frightening things that can happen is watching that all take place and knowing or not knowing what's happening with that student. The other thing is it's got to be very difficult to be in the schools when everything is legal. If this is legal to do, but here you are in school trying to function. And so I think that you need to have that backing, you know, of the law. And that's why I would support that law.
Further questions, and then we'll go to discussion shortly. Representative Grunhagen and then Szymanski. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I agree with Representative Johnson's comments that it's a multifaceted approach, and having been on the school board for over a decade, I've had a great concern about the use of illegal substances for young people and the marketing of it. But as a school board member, I oppose the majority, if not all, of the sex and drug education programs in our schools, and the reason is they are based on a majority of them are based on a faulty psychological educational technique that actually makes our children more susceptible to negative behavior and the use of illegal substances. That faulty psychological technique is based on Dr. Abe Maslow's pyramid of needs and self-actualization and Dr. Carl Rogers' feeling-centered decision maker. Again, it produces a negative effect on our children and makes them more susceptible to illegal drug use. If the committee would be interested in specific examples of that curriculum, I could bring it sometime in testimony to the committee. Thank you.
Representative Szymanski, and then we'll see if there's any further testimony. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief Schnell, if you or your officers stopped a driver under the influence of this synthetic marijuana, could they apply a DWI, a driving while intoxicated, citation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Szymanski, it's a great question, and I think the issue in the law around DWI enforcement is really about impairment. Can we, in fact, establish impairment? The drug recognition experts from the Minnesota State Patrol and law enforcement agencies across the state are now looking at the effects of synthetic marijuana and trying to establish the connection. As long as we can determine that it was illegal drug use that was caused the impairment that was observed in driving, it could be an arrestable offense. Clearly, I think establishing this as a controlled substance would be helpful in terms of the overall impact of the substance on driving behavior.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just comment on
County Attorney? Yes.
Thank you. while it may in fact be an arrestable offense, I can tell you that it would be extremely difficult to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal court. If you outlaw it, it's going to make it much easier for us to prove that. So.
Very good, gentlemen. Seeing no questions further of these testifiers, thank you, Dr. Conboy, Chief Schnell, County Attorney Baxter. Are there any? Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Okay, come. I see one hand up. Come forward, give us your name, and go ahead.
My name is Michael Harrison. I'm the Director of Judicial Common Sense, which is here mainly for an overview of the sentencing guideline. But listening to some of the questions and discussions, I Representative Lieber brought a good point to my mind. A couple years ago, we passed laws where now to buy Sudafed, I have to show an ID and go to the prescription counter at the drug store to obtain the drug, where prior before I could just go grab it off the shelf and pay for it. This has also impacted my life in another way, is that I had to take a urine test. I was asked if I took prescription medications, and I said no, because I'm not one to go to a doctor very often. It's like trying to pull teeth from a tiger. But I do have allergies, and I often use Sudafed quite a bit. When I did the urine test and I said no, they came back and said we tested for positive, our dirty UA is what I was told. And that was because Sudafed, I guess, is used to make methamphetamine, and that is why you passed your law. My concern here is that although I support the bill and I do have a minor child, or two minor children, one in high school, which would concern me very much if she was to get involved with this stuff. But we're going to criminalize this, and when innocent people are using this, they are the ones that will have to bear the consequences of this bill. So I would like to see some language put into it so that people like me who are legitimately buying this stuff, and I don't know why anybody would, but if they would, you know, I don't think that they should be made to be criminalized. Thank you.
Thank you. Response, questions, Representative Liebling, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, to the testifier, appreciate your coming to say that. I just want to let you know that, you know, I was actually here and involved in passing that very law that you're talking about, and I just want to tell you that even though we knew when we passed it that it would impact people's ability to buy Sudafed and so on, and I don't think that if Sudafed had not been behind the counter, that still would have occurred, your situation. But I just want to let you and the committee know that that is one of the most successful things that I have done since I've been at the legislature, because we were dealing with meth labs that were terribly destructive, terribly bad for law enforcement, for everybody, environmentally horrible, all over the state, especially in the rural areas and in my area in southeast Minnesota. And after we did that, the incidence of those labs dropped enormously. We still get methamphetamine in the state, of course, it's imported, but I think, you know, the last I heard about this, that was a tremendously successful policy change. And so I just want to say, you know, I'm not against doing those kinds of things. I just want to see good evidence that it's going to really have the impact, because there is always an unintended consequence. We're limiting somebody's freedom when we make a new law, so we need to make sure that it's really worth doing. So thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further witnesses, public testimony is closed. And is there any further discussion among committee members? Representative Tilbury.
I just have one comment, and also the invitation by Representative Grunhagen. I'd be interested in seeing that research, because if you have information that says less prevention and less education is better, I'd love to see that.
No, I didn't mean...
Representative Greenhagen.
Mr. Chairman, no, I didn't mean less. I said the techniques that are used in the curriculum that are based on, it's humanistic psychology, actually make our children more susceptible to negative and the use of illegal drug addiction.
And to respond to that, I need to see it. Thank you.
Okay, I'll work on that this weekend and bring some of it along for you. Thank you.
Further discussion? All right, Representative Kressley, you had a motion before us that House File 57 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Registry. You want to renew that?
I would, Mr. Chair. I would like to renew my motion to pass House File 57 and move it to the General Register.
That's the motion before us. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Kressley. 57 is recommended to pass and is sent to the General Register.
Thank you, committee members.
All right, now the next last thing on our agenda is the Sentencing Guidelines Commission agency overview. I think we have Jeffrey Edblad and Jill Payne here to testify. You'll wait for a moment till the previous gentleman can leave. Looks like you're setting up some kind of toy over there, so I guess we'll just wait. Ready? Go ahead. Identify yourselves and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for inviting us today. My name is Jeff Edblad. I am the Isanti County Attorney, and I am currently the chair of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. With me is Interim Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, Jill Payne. And this morning, Ms. Payne will be giving a brief overview of the agency following a brief overview that I'll be presenting with regard to the guidelines and the commission itself. Minnesota created the nation's first sentencing guidelines commission in 1978 for crimes occurring on or after August 1st of 1980. And a sentencing guidelines system provides the legislature with a structure for determining and maintaining a rational sentencing policy. Through the development of the sentencing guidelines, the legislature determines what the goals and purposes of the state's sentencing system will be. The guidelines generally represent the goals of the criminal justice system and specifically recommend the appropriate sentence for an individual based upon the severity level of that criminal offense, as well as the specific offender's criminal history. It is important to note that a majority, 74.9%, of felony offenders in the state of Minnesota do get the recommended guideline sentence under the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. And also, it's important to note that the guidelines themselves do not apply to certain types of offenses that carry mandatory life sentences, such as first-degree murder and certain criminal sexual conduct offenses. With regard to the guidelines structure, the vertical axis of the guidelines represents the severity level of the offense, going on the low end from a severity level 1 to the high end of a severity level 11, 11 being the most severe.
Excuse me for a moment. There is no presentation on the screens. Is there a problem?
Mr. Chair, there's no problem. We're just it was just setting it up.
Okay, if you encounter one, let me know. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I had mentioned, the system is set up on a grid axis system, with the vertical axes representing the severity level of the offense, ranging on the low end at a severity level 1 to a high end of a severity level 11, with 11 being the most severe. The
Say again.
We're going to get Bill, who can help us out here. I don't know why her laptop is
not. Do the witnesses want to suspend Bill for a few moments, or do you want to proceed?
We will go with the preference of the committee, Mr. Chair. What would you like?
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't you go ahead, and we've got ears besides eyeballs, so we'll listen to what you're saying. And then when your computer gets up and running, you may take a couple minutes to just simply go back and recap. So go ahead.
Sounds fine. With regard to the grid structure itself, the horizontal axes on the grid represents the offender's criminal history, and it includes such factors as prior convictions for felonies, certain convictions for targeted misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors, custody status, as well as a certain formula for a potential juvenile criminal history point. The cell grids themselves, or the cells on the grid, each has a recommended duration, and the dispositional line, or the long dark line going through the grid, is the line that distinguishes prison cases from probation cases. In 2006, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission created a separate sex offender grid in recognition of the unique nature and some of the complex issues regarding criminal sexual conduct offenses. And there is a separate grid in and of itself for attempted first-degree murder cases.
By the way, we are up and running. Go ahead.
Currently, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission is in a period of transition. We are an 11-member body created by the legislature. 8 of the members are appointed by the governor. We are currently awaiting most of Governor Dayton's appointees. The remaining 3 members are appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, each representing a different branch of the Minnesota court system. The commission consists of 3 judges, one from the district court, Ed Cleary in St. Paul, one from the appellate court, Gordy Schumacher from the Court of Appeals, one from the Supreme Court, Justice Helen Meyer. We also have the Commissioner of Corrections, Tom Roy, is an appointed member of the Guidelines Commission per statute. There is one licensed peace officer. That is currently a vacant spot. An elected county attorney, myself. Defense attorney Darcy Bentz from the public defender's system, Tracy Jensen, a probation officer from Washington County, and 3 citizens, Reverend Robert Battle, Carrie Berman, as well as Connie Larson. One of the 3 must be the victim of a violent crime. And as I had mentioned, we're currently in transition awaiting 7 of Governor Dayton's 8 appointees to the body. The goals of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines consist of the following. We maintain and modify the sentencing guidelines that govern felony sentences in the state in order to support Minnesota sentencing goals. Primary goal by statute is to ensure public safety. We also want to promote uniformity and consistency in sentencing so that offenders who are convicted of similar crimes that have similar criminal history scores receive similar sentences. A goal is also to provide truth and certainty in sentencing. And when we talk about truth and certainty, we're talking about a determinate sentencing structure where offenders actually receive the amount of time that is pronounced by the court at the time of sentencing. We also have the goal of establishing proportionality in sentencing by establishing and emphasizing a just deserts philosophy where the punishment fits the crime. First-time offenders convicted of violent offenses and those offenders that have more extensive nonviolent criminal records are the individuals that are recommended for prison sentences in the state of Minnesota. As the committee is aware, there is no parole board in the state of Minnesota making early release decisions, and that offenders sentenced to prison must serve at least 2/3 of the pronounced time in prison, where the remainder, 1/3 of the time, is spent on supervised release with the Department of Corrections. The number of felons sentenced over time in Minnesota has gone up considerably, and I kind of think of it from a generational standpoint. When I was a freshman in college in 1981, there were 5,500 felons sentenced in the state of Minnesota. Comparing to 2009, a generation later, when my oldest son was a college freshman, there were 14,840 felons sentenced. From the time of 1981 to 2009, it's been a 170% increase in the amount of felons sentenced in the state of Minnesota. Also, during this time period, the guidelines have become more complex, and we have seen sentence lengths increasing. For example, felony domestic assault offenses are up 371% since 2006, due in part to a broader statutory definition. This has created a need for 324 prison beds and 161 jail beds. However, Minnesota does continue to experience an overall decrease in the number of felons sentenced, beginning in 2007 when we saw 16,168 felons sentenced. In 2009, there were 14,840 felony offenders sentenced, which is a 3.6% decrease from the 15,394 sentenced in 2008. And as a note to the committee, 90.8% of all felony offenders in Minnesota get pronounced incarceration in either a state prison or in a local county jail facility. The downward trend in felony sentences appears to be the result of a decline in both the number of felony DWI offenders sentenced as well as the number of drug offenders sentenced, namely meth offenders. And we had some conversation with regard to the last presentation in regard to the impact of the behind-the-counter law with Sudafed and how that has significantly impacted the meth lab cases that were ravaging my part of the state as well. The only crime category exhibiting growth is in the area of person crimes, and we've seen a 6% increase, with much of that growth coming from the domestic assault-related offenses as well as first-degree assaults. The National Center for State Courts released a report in 2008 entitled Assessing Consistency and Fairness in Sentencing, a Comparative Study in Three States. And the National Center for State Courts compared the guideline structures in Minnesota, which was considered to have a relatively strict sentencing system, the state of Michigan, where there was more judicial discretion and latitude granted, as well as the state of Virginia, which has voluntary guidelines. And the study found that Minnesota's guidelines offer higher predictability due to the compact set of elements used to determine criminal history, as well as comparatively narrow guideline ranges. And the National Center for State Courts report also indicates that the guidelines make sentencing more transparent and limited the undesirable sentencing disparity by reducing such factors as race and economic background. Low incarceration rates reflect one of the key principles of the sentencing guidelines. And we recognize the fact that correctional facilities are finite and that sanctions used in sentencing convicted felons should be the least restrictive necessary to achieve the purposes of sentencing. In a 2008 comparison, the Bureau of Justice Statistics determined that Minnesota's incarceration rate was the second lowest of all states in the nation, despite, as of 2009, Minnesota being the 21st most populous state, the only state that has an incarceration rate lower than Minnesota is the state of Maine. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics report by mid-year of 2008, Minnesota's incarceration rate was 179 individuals per 100,000 residents. As I had mentioned earlier, only Maine had a lower rate than Minnesota, 151 per 100,000 residents. And in comparison, Louisiana has the highest rate at 153 incarcerated per 100,000 residents. A major responsibility of the commission is to maintain the guideline structure by annually modifying the sentencing guidelines. In 2010, the commission responded to a number of areas. We responded to legislative changes with regard to new statutes that were passed by the Minnesota legislature. Specifically, we dealt with the readdressing the sentencing on the possession of a firearm on school property. We addressed the sentencing structure for the crime of using the handheld device with regard to identity theft. We also respond to the appellate courts with regard to new case law that raises questions or concerns with regard to the application and interpretation of the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. And we also address issues raised by concerned parties, issues raised by probation groups, by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, by the Public Defenders Association, as well as various victim groups. And it was an example of the victim groups raising an issue that led to the moving of certain prostitution offenses from the sex offender or to the sex offender grid from the main sentencing guidelines grid. During 2010, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission met five times, and we held one public hearing. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at this time I will turn the presentation over to Ms. Payne, Interim Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Payne, give us your name and then go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Payne. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I'm going to speak briefly about the structure of our staff and also some of the tasks that we do in our office. We have six members of our staff, beginning with the executive director, who works closely with the commission and also the legislature. We have a management analyst who does the majority of our training and outreach and also does administrative tasks in our office. And then we have four researchers who work with the databases and the data themselves. Last year, we collected sentences for all felons who were sentenced in 2009. Again, as Mr. Ed Bled said, that's 14,840 offenders. We trained over 500 practitioners, and that included attorneys, judges, and probation officers. We responded to 100 data requests coming from members of the public, attorneys, judges, academics, people from other sentencing commissions who were interested in Minnesota's structure. We answered 2,500 sentencing guidelines related phone calls. Most of those came from probation officers, some from judges, attorneys, victims, and offenders. We prepared 28 fiscal impact requests last year, and also 8 from this session. And oftentimes we had to do that with a very quick turnaround time of 3 days or less. And beginning in 2006, our commission began providing racial impact notes to the legislature on proposed crime bills when a disparate impact was anticipated. We were actually the first to do that in the nation, and since then, Iowa and Connecticut have enacted laws to do the same. Last year, we collaborated with the Department of Corrections, and we continue to do that to generate the prison bed projections. And you may have heard from them earlier that our projections are off by 0.3% as of February 1st. So that's a difference of 31 offenders. And as Mr. Edblad said, it's that predictability that we're talking about that it allows us to do that. Our staff served on various boards and forums and committees, including the Department of Corrections Statewide Supervision System Advisory Board and the State Court's Racial Fairness Subcommittee on Drug Offenses and the Drug Court Evaluation Committee. We distributed sentencing guidelines to all probation officers throughout the state in all 87 counties, and we made other reports available on our website. Last year, our agency reduced its operating expenses, which I'll talk about briefly in a moment. We also found new ways to use technology For example, our agency worked with the state courts to implement a new way to retrieve sentencing information from their MNSIS, the state court MNSIS system. The technology saved us countless hours, and the project was accomplished within our budget and within the court's budget. Our budget for 2 years is $1.12 million. The majority of that is for personnel, and 15% is for operating expenses. And to give you an idea of what that looks like over time, our biennial budget was actually reduced by 8% from fiscal year 08-09 to fiscal year 10-11, and that's $99,000. And to give you a comparison of what that looks like with other sentencing commissions throughout the nation, we're the second lowest as far as FTEs, employees, and also budget. Arkansas being lower, and it's important, we're trying to do a very apples to apples comparison here, but to be fair, Pennsylvania receives federal funding as well. They have a federal grant and they have 12 employees. In fiscal year 10 and 11, our commission cut one staff position and we reduced our operating expenses. As I said before, we moved to a state-owned building, which saved us 34% of our budget for rent. We gained efficiencies when we made that move as well. We switched to the state's Office of Technology desktop support, and that left more time for our staff to focus on its core functions and less time to work on that IT-related tasks. We also reduced our in-state travel. We held more webinars. We extended and expanded our training materials on our website. And we provided more reports online versus on paper. Currently, our now reduced staff is able to meet the current demands and to fulfill its core functions, but we would become overextended quickly with any further reductions. Thank you. I just wanted to also point out that, again, our reports are available on our website. Our legislative report is on our website. And if you're interested in the summary statistics, that's our sentencing practices data report is there as well. And as you know, our agency profile is on the MMB website. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. We'll go to questions. Mr. Edblad, who's prosecuting the criminals up in Isani when you're here with us today? Are you taking care of that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've got a very effective staff, and my chief deputy, Amy Reed Hall, is holding down the fort. I've currently got six assistants, seven including myself, that have active court calendars.
I figured you were maintaining that front. Representatives Johnson, Szymanski, then Hillstrom. And then Lesh, Representative Johnson. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this to you, Mr. Edblad. Given the fiscal times we're in now with the extremely tight budget now and in this biennium into the foreseeable future, does the Sentencing Guideline Commission take those fiscal problems into account and review sentencing guidelines given the fact that the money is going to be so short and prison sentences are such a length? I mean, do you take that factor in account and review what the current sentencing guidelines are?
Mr. Edblad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, what we do is when the legislature is looking at passing a new law, we look at the fiscal impact of that as it relates to bed space, but there is no ongoing, I guess, evaluation as to the financial issue of bed space and current sentencing determinations.
Representative Johnson.
And so then just briefly, you don't initiate, you just generally just respond to the legislature. You don't initiate any suggested changes that might make sense. Is that correct?
Mr. Edblatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that is correct with regard to the financial impact of things. We do initiate certain actions. We initiated, I'll give you for example, we did initiate by looking at the events that were taking place with regard to sex offender sentencing, looking at some of the sex offender sentences with the upward departures, looking at the United States Supreme Court Blakely decision in 2004, and looking at the also the time period around that time was the sexual psychopath commitment issues coming up. We did look at and initiate the sex offender sentencing grid to try to address those issues. So we are not 100% reactive. We are proactive in some areas, and that's an example where we're proactive. But from the standpoint of the dollars, how much is it costing to have this many offenders at this offense severity level per year, we have not initiated anything of that nature.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Edblatt, I have two questions, not really related. First one, on the incarceration rates by comparison, could you just review those numbers again? You gave us Minnesota, Maine, and I believe Louisiana.
Ms. Payne, Mr. Edblatt.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd have a follow-up question on a different topic.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe, is it the Louisiana number that's in
yes.
question?
Right.
It's actually, it's higher. It's 800 and...
853 per 100,000
okay.
residents.
All right. Okay. I was unclear on that. Thank you. And then if I, on the sentencing grid structure, if a conviction is laid down in the criminal justice system, do you look at the criminal's record from other states, other nations, those types of things? Do they play into the sentencing guidelines?
Ms. Payne.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we take into account any federal offenses, out-of-state convictions. It's really up to the probation officer or the pre-sentence investigator to gather the person's criminal history and then apply it to the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. So that is taken into account as well.
Mr. Chair, if I may just ask
Representative Szymanski, yeah.
A short one. Is there any guideline in here for human trafficking? Is that an offense that would come into this grid?
Ms. Payne.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is in fact something that was recently looked at by the legislature and is ranked under the prostitution offenses, which will be included in the sex offender grid beginning August 1st of this year.
All right, Representative Hillstrom, then Lesh. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine will be more a comment than a question. I'm looking forward to there being a new sentencing guidelines and some things that I care about that I'm hoping that might come up is you only count juvenile points until the age of 25. So after the juvenile reaches the age of 25, you can't use the point anymore. The consecutive versus concurrent situation, many of you may not know that, you know, if you commit a crime and you're going to prison, there's a whole list of crimes that you may be committing at the same time, or days apart or months apart, where it's presumptive that you're going to go to prison one time and count all the time for all of those offenses. So the consecutive versus concurrent sometimes becomes an issue. And then the other thing that members may not know is that you count a point 15 years from the time someone is discharged from probation. So if you go to prison for an offense and then you get out and you are on probation for 15 years, 15 years later, those points don't count anymore on the ranking. So if you have a career criminal, their points decay over time and end up going to prison less for some offense later on. And then the last thing that I am interested in is the fact that the commission gets to re-rank offenses without having to count the fiscal note, and we have to count a fiscal note for every time we introduce a new piece of legislation to increase sentences. So just keep that in mind. as you, you know, make your re-rankings and things that we have to pay for ours and you don't have to pay for yours, and that's a little sensitive to us sometimes.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. First is for Mr. Ed Blad. And by way of explanation to the new members of the committee, when we're talking about indeterminate sentencing versus determinate sentencing, 1978, we went to a determinate sentencing system, which you hear in the movies or TV, someone gets 10 to 20 or 10 to life or 20 to life. That's indeterminate. You could get 10, you could get 20. Determinate is you get it in the box up there on the screen, and you get a portion of it on supervised release, so you don't need to have a parole board deciding when you're going to get out of prison because the grid decides it. When we moved from that in 1978, we dispensed with the need of having a parole board. But we reenacted a portion of that in 2005 with the sex offender laws, and I don't think I heard it at the end of your presentation. As this is the answer to the question that I think I knew back in 2005 when we passed it, but I don't remember anymore. Why don't we have a parole board again for the decision of those slice of indeterminate sentencings that we have from that law?
Ms. Payne?
Mr. Chair, Representative, is your question, is there a review for those life sentences? Is that the question? I apologize.
Representative Lesh.
Maybe, what's that? Yes. I mean, I know we have an end of confinement review committee, but we do not have the equivalent of what the parole board did. And my understanding is the end of confinement review committee makes the decisions about the score they have of whether they're a level 1, 2, or 3 offender and whatnot, but no one to decide how someone gets the extra time they could potentially get based on the indeterminate sentence that we passed in 2005.
Ms. Payne?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I apologize, I'm not the authority on this, but if someone receives a life sentence, you know, they can have a life without the possibility of release, or there can be a life sentence with the possibility of release. In those cases, they must first serve the minimum of a life sentence before they can be reviewed and potentially released from prison.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, this is kind of a technical question, so I know there are people in this room, up at the back of the room, who could answer it, so I could possibly ask that offline as well. But I do have a second question.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair. Second question is, a year ago at this time, I was a week away from graduation down at Fort Benning with a bunch of guys from basic training, one of whom served a year in a Mexican prison for running guns across the border. Yeah, believe it or not. And he actually tried to get into the Marines, but the Marines wouldn't let him in because of this old gun-running conviction. Representative Wardlow, your dad would be proud of that. Marines wouldn't let him in. Army let him in. But what happened was he was one of four guys who got caught running M16s across the border into Mexico. He got caught by the Mexican authorities, and they put him in jail for 10 years. And one of the guys squealed, made a deal with U.S. feds, and they shipped him to serve his time in the States. The rest of the guys said, we're not turning over because we're dead men if we turn over. We're just going to sit tight in this Mexican prison here and, you know, see what will. Well, within 5 months, the Mexican authorities came in and said, yeah, it's too crowded in here. You guys are shipped out, and dropped them off in the front step of the prison. At what point do we make that decision because of prison overcrowding in Minnesota? And who makes that decision? And back in the old days, it was a warden who would just make that decision. But how would that process run when we start running into that problem here in Minnesota?
Mr. Edblatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I understand your question, you're talking about some of the concerns that are raised with an indeterminate sentencing structure?
Well,
Representative Blatt.
That, Mr. Chair, that was my first question, Mr. Edblatt. Right now, this question is simply about overcrowding. I mean, if we get a point where you as a prosecutor are shipping too many people into Stillwater or St. Cloud than they can handle, how does that get resolved?
Mr. Edblatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as far as shipping people into prison and how does it get resolved, there are some mechanisms in place with regard to the drug offenses that the legislature changed, giving the Department of Corrections some authority as it relates to boot camp programs and certain type of release programs. As far as the problem, you've illustrated the problem that I have always seen with an indeterminate sentencing structure, is that for reasons often that don't even bump up against public safety, decisions are made in an indeterminate sentencing system to release offenders from prison that may not be the best candidates for release. That certainly isn't a comment on your friend and his colleagues and their release situation, but public safety is not always well served when nose counts and dollars and who gets out the door are the primary factors.
Okay.
Any further questions or comments? I don't see any. I want to thank both of you, Mr. Edblad and Ms. Pierce.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, seeing no further business, I would like to just last of all, maybe thank Representative Szymanski for chairing this committee earlier in the week. I wasn't here, and you may have noticed I wasn't here for a couple of days. I just want to share on the record I'm with you. I wasn't feeling too well starting on Thursday, and by Sunday evening, my son suggested I get in the car, and I went to an area hospital. And after 2.5 days of poking around at me, the doctors felt like I was getting sentenced. The doctors gave me two prescriptions, one for some pills to cut back on acid in my stomach because he suggested I was getting an ulcer. And the second prescription was, go back to the legislature and stop arguing all the time. And I said, well, doctor, I'll take the pills, but in my committee, we chat now and then, but we never argue. So thank you, Representative Chairman. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.